My name is Lenka Patton, and I'm the VP of HR at Reebok, and I'm very excited to be MC for today's session. It looks like it's a session that everybody in the room is very passionate about, and I'm really, really excited. We have so many people here today. I'm also really excited about Reebok partnering with the Massachusetts Conference for Women, because it's a mission of the conference is very much close to what Reebok's mission and values and core values are. Advancement of women from a development and leadership perspective, it's definitely something to strive for and stand behind. You might know or not know that Reebok is actually women's first brand, and what it means is that we really do care at Reebok about how women thrive, but not only physically, which you would expect naturally from a company like Reebok, but also mentally and socially. And this is really a part of the core mission of and core values of the company. So being a part of the conference today is something that's, that we are very passionate about. There are a couple of things I think that we do at Reebok as well that I would like to quickly tie to what the session is about today. I don't know if you know it, but we just moved to Boston. Some of us might follow it or not, but we're about 10 minutes away from here. And I think the new building is actually something that when I was learned I was going to be MC for this session was super exciting, because our new building is creating a space where I think people can connect much more, people can really collaborate much better, but people can also find time for themselves to go and exercise. And actually, we have a policy in place that if people exercise more, it gets free, actually. And we have a lot of different things in place, and so it was very, very exciting to see that we can actually be a part of the session today that's really trying to instill a bit more Zen in people's life overall. But without further delay, I would really like to introduce our two amazing speakers, two amazing women that are going to be spending the next hour with us. And again, I think the full house here is a sign that this is a topic that probably a lot of us really care about and probably we haven't figured out yet, because the answers might come today. So we have two great speakers, Bridget Schulte and Gretchen Stewart. Bridget is actually an author of a New York Times best-selling book about time pressure, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play, When No One Has the Time. I did have to read the title because I could not remember it, but it really encompasses so many things in that one sentence, and I do have to read that book. She has spoken in many places and many times on time and productivity, and also the consequences of a lifestyle that makes us constantly plugged in. I think the other thing that Bridget is focusing on that's really exciting is how we kind of rethink the gender roles that we play in the society, and how does it change the division of labor, and whether it's at home and whether it's at work, but then how that renegotiation creates an opportunity or different opportunity for women at home and at work. She's a journalist by trade. She was a part of Washington Post and Washington Post magazine, and actually was a part of a team that won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize, which is very exciting. She's also now the founding director of the Good Life Initiative and a Better Life Lab. So there's a theme there for sure. You might have heard her on a radio or seen on a TV, because she has been in many of these outlets before: NBC Nightly News, Good Morning America, BBC News, NPR Fresh Air, and others. So welcome, Bridget Schulte. Gretchen Stewart is our other speaker today, and she is the author of The Joy Manifesto. And I actually Googled it, and I'm going to read the description because I couldn't remember it either, which is a 90-day custom journal planner to help you design and plan your joyous dream life. And I did want to quote it word by word because it was so connecting to me when I was reading. I was like, that's exactly what I need. So I'm super excited that this is the theme of our session today. We'll learn about this more today, but a little bit more about Gretchen. She has worked in so many different industries, and when I was reading her bio, I realized she was doing so many different things in her life, and kind of connecting it all together through her work is really inspiring. She was a nurse, she was a disaster relief volunteer, author, business owner, and she really traveled the world, all around the world, extremely extensively. So lots of great experience there. And she also started a boutique publishing company, which is called Sunshine Press. And the mission of this boutique company is to publish work that's inspirational, and it's really inspiring people to potentially change their life. With that, let's welcome Gretchen as well. So I would like to invite you both, take your seat and take it from there.
All right, well, thank you so much, Lenka. And good morning, everybody. Great to be here with Gretchen. Let me just start, like, how many of you have felt maybe a little busy, overwhelmed, a little stressed out in the last 24 hours, the last week? So yeah, we're going to be talking about busyness, and it's one of the themes that I wrote about in my book. It's certainly, we all need a joy manifesto to try to figure out what to do about it. So what we thought we would do, we're going to have a conversation, and then we want to open it up to have, you know, more of a full group conversation about, like, how we got here, what are the consequences, and then what do we do about it. And so very briefly, we thought we'd start talking about our own stories about how we got here. So, as Lenka said, I'm a journalist. For many years, I was at the Washington Post, and I never wrote about this kind of stuff. I wrote about, like, war and bombs and guns and politics and, like, you know, all the stuff that you see on the front page and snowstorms and all that kind of stuff. And there was a couple years ago, I had two really little, my kids were pretty, I have two kids, they were still small. I was working like a maniac. I was feeling like I was a totally inadequate mother. I never worked out. I was sleeping maybe 5 hours a night. I just was constantly like, I felt like I was sort of burning my candle at both ends and out the middle and holding on by my fingernails. And we were doing this research at the Washington Post, like trying to figure out, we'd seen that women were not reading the newspaper as much as men. And so they appointed this Women Readers Committee to try to figure out why. So I'm part of this Women Readers Committee, and we all sit down, and it became this like weird confessional, because it's like, we didn't read the newspaper in the morning, and we worked for the newspaper. You know, that's because mornings were crazy. You're trying to get the kids out the door, and, you know, you're making lunches, and you're emptying the dishwasher. And, you know, it was only later that I realized that I was this Tasmanian devil, and my husband was sitting there with his half glasses on, reading the paper, drinking his coffee. It was almost like we were on different planets. But that realization came later. So at this Women Readers Committee, we're like, well, duh, women aren't reading the newspaper. Women are really busy. And so being reporters and investigative journalists, we wanted to find the data. Well, okay, what's the data that women are so busy? So not knowing anything, I'm like, well, I don't know. I'll find out. So God bless Google. Busy. Women. Mothers. Time. Enter. And then I found like this whole line of research that I'd never heard about. Sociologists, psychologists, economists who use time diaries, time use research. So I called up this one guy who's considered Father Time. He's like, knows everything about time. And I called him up. I'm like, yeah, we're doing this report on how women aren't reading the newspaper. We figured they're just too busy. And he interrupts me and he goes, wrong. Women aren't busy. So I was like, well, who are you talking to? He's going, women have 30 hours of leisure a week. They have more leisure time now than they did in the 1960s, even though more of them work in the marketplace. And it was one of those moments, I can't remember if I dropped the phone, if I fell over backwards. I was like, I finally said, I kind of came back to my senses. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have 30 hours of leisure. And he said, yes, you do. Come and do a time study with me, and I will show you where your leisure is. And honest to God, that is how I got to be sitting on this stage today, because I did that time use research. I did that time diary. It took me about a year and a half to finally gather enough time, like, because I would start, you know, I would start writing down my time on Monday, and then I would forget to do it on Tuesday, and by Wednesday I'd completely forgotten what I'd done, but I knew I was really busy. I just didn't know what I did. So I finally got enough data, and I went to him, and I did. I felt like it was judgment day, you know, because I've never been particularly good at time. And like I said, I was feeling totally inadequate in every sphere of my life. And so sort of like Father Time, judgment day, I kind of passed my little journals over to him. You know, here's my time. And I was really worried, you know, because part of me wanted, I was so angry, I wanted to prove him wrong. It's like, you don't know what it feels like to be a woman today. You don't know what it feels like to be a working mother. You know, you're this, you know, old man, you know, in their 70s, and you've never had to, like, figure out how to bake cupcakes for the Valentine's party, and, you know, your kids are going to cry, and then you're on deadline, and some a-hole editor calls you and wants to change it all at 11 o'clock at night. You don't know what that's like. So I wanted to prove him wrong, but on the other hand, I was really afraid, because what if he was right? And this is my one and only life, and I'm just like screaming past, it's like screaming past me, and you know, I'm not feeling like I'm living it fully. I'm sort of on the sidelines and freaked out and breaking out in stress eczema. And so so he looked at my journal, and one of the reasons I love the cover of my book so much is he took out a highlighter, a yellow highlighter, and he started highlighting all the stuff that he said was my leisure time. You know, so every time I got to exercise, reach, leisure, I'm like, ah, I hate exercise. It's like, no, exercise is leisure, you know. And then I was stuck in my old station wagon. I was taking my daughter to her ballet class. And we, you know, my station wagon broke down on the side of the road yet again, and we were waiting for a tow truck for 2 hours. Preach. Leisure. I'm like, you're kidding me. He goes, oh, that's right, you're with your daughter, so that's childcare time. I'm like, so if I had been by myself in the car, that would have been my leisure time? And he kind of shrugged, and he's like, yeah. And so with those very low bar of what leisure was, he found 27 and a half hours of leisure in my schedule 1 week. And I about burst into tears, because to me, it was bits and scraps of garbage time. You know, it was like time confetti. It didn't mean anything. It was like 10 minutes between waiting for something and like and 15 minutes here. And so that really started me on this journey. I wrote a magazine story for the Washington Post magazine, sort of this search for this elusive 30 hours of leisure. And I remember I was curled up in the fetal position the day that it came out, because I was sure that people were going to think I was this crazy, neurotic, disorganized person, and I didn't want to know. And instead, I got so many emails and calls. Well, if you read the online comments, yes, you're neurotic, you're crazy, you're an idiot. But that's online comments. But the emails, the letters, I ended up having to print them out because I was worried that the system was going to break down in the Washington Post. Turned out to be a stack this high, and it was women and men and people with kids and without kids and young people and old people and retired people. And most of them said, you climbed into my head and you wrote about my life. And that's when I wanted to figure out, all right, why are we all feeling so overwhelmed and so busy? I wanted to know, why are things the way they are, and how can they be better? What can we do about it? And sort of take those skills as a journalist to go look. So I'll talk about that later. Over to you, Gretchen. How did you get here?
So nice to be here. So in my previous life, in my 20s, I was an ER and ICU nurse. And then I picked up and moved out of the country. I lived in Europe for a while, and then I lived in Costa Rica. And when I was in Costa Rica, I owned a business that I did not love. And simultaneously, I started getting sick. I ended up having a pretty debilitating illness, which was a great thing, and I'll tell you why in a second. So while I was in Costa Rica, I was trying to find myself. I was struggling. I was doing something that was not congruent for me. I didn't like the business. It was a bar restaurant. And so I started health and fitness coaching. And I dove into it, and I pushed myself hard, and at the same time I had my daughter, and I'm pushing myself to do something because I wanted to help people, but again, it was something that wasn't congruent for me. So I was pushing. I was busy. I was working online. I was unhappy. I was taking time away from my daughter. I was feeling inadequate unless I had this thing in my head, I have to make six figures in order to be an adequate person. I have to do this. I need to have this accolade. I needed more, more, more. I just was constantly taking myself away from my family, neglecting my health, and never achieving happiness or joy. So we moved back to the States, and my illness got worse. I was on the couch trying to raise my daughter, which, and now I have a son, but at the time of my real, the illness, it was partially due to genetics, but then it was also partially due to extreme burnout. I just let myself go. I neglected myself, and I pushed myself into a direction that wasn't right for me, and I didn't take care of myself. So with that, I started researching, reading, opening up my eyes, and fast approaching 40, and I said, I need to find the silver lining to this stress. Why did I get so stressed? Why did I get so sick? I'm young and healthy, but at the same time, I can't get off the couch. One day, my husband brought me flowers, and I just absolutely, I was grateful, but I dreaded having to get off the couch to go cut them and put them in a vase of water. Like, that whole idea of that was just too much. So what good could come from my pain and suffering? I was a nurse. I was a caring person. I want to give back. I want to be significant. So what can I do? And I just wiped the slate clean and decided to start over. And that's when I wrote the Joy Manifesto. I got to the basics. I did research, and I experimented. And I basically quieted my mind, and I stopped consuming everybody else's creations. I stopped chasing somebody else's dream. I stopped being busy just for the sake of being busy. I stopped neglecting my priorities, which are my health and my family. And so I came up with a few things that were extremely important to me. And then with that Joy Manifesto, I kind of retrained my brain. I started thinking differently. I found gratitude. I found joy in simple things. I found more leisure time because I turned everything else off. And so since I did that, then I started my publishing company, and I actually just published another book, Simplicity, just in time for you guys for the conference, digitally. And all while doing all these things, I'm starting a nonprofit called the Elon Project. All while doing these things, I have a lot of leisure time, and I took the stress off my shoulders. Now I have a 3- and a 6-year-old, so yes, life does get a little bit busy, and sometimes I have to do things that I don't think are fun, but I'm honoring my family and I'm honoring my life, and everything that comes my way, I think about with intention, and I do things with purpose, and that's the short story. I'm sure we'll talk more about it.
Yeah, no, that's great, and I guess I would say I'm still a work in progress, so yeah, I'm still working on that. But I'll share with you, it sounds like, you know, let's talk about kind of what we learned and, you know, kind of going through this. So as a reporter, I wanted to figure out, all right, what does this busyness mean and where did it come from? And at first, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., where everybody's type A and busy and stuck in traffic all the time. So I thought, all right, you know, so maybe this busyness is really just kind of a coastal thing or it's big cities. And so I was looking for people who, you know, like were smarter than me that did research. And so I found this sociologist, and he was studying frenetic families in L.A. I'm like, perfect. I'll go spend some time with him in frenetic families. And he did say something that was really interesting, that, you know, these families were crazy and they were doing all this stuff, but they kind of got this weird sense of pride. Like, look at this busy calendar and what we were able to do. They weren't very happy. They were all exhausted. But there was sort of like this weird sense of pride. And I thought, that's really interesting. And so I was going to go spend time with him, but then he called me up and he said, I'm too busy. You can't come spend time with me. So then, you know, my deadline was approaching, and I had this whole big chapter that I'd planned on busyness. I'm like, oh my God, where am I going to find, you know, where am I going to find, like, what I'm going to write about? And so I went to this one kind of archive of sociological research, and I found this woman who studies the fast pace of life and busyness in Fargo, North Dakota. So I called her up. I'm like, Fargo? You know, don't you all like sit around on the porch and after supper and, you know, I don't know, listen to country music or something? And she just goes, oh, honey, you want to meet some overwhelmed North Dakotans? I can arrange that. So I went out to Fargo, North Dakota, and we did a couple things. She arranged a focus group, and I spent some time with this focus group. And, you know, sitting around the table, there were men and women. So it's not just a woman thing. It's not just a mother thing, although I think that we're sort of the, you know, that's the canary in the coal mine where it's most stressful. But, you know, there was a guy there. He's like, oh, I have a canoe. I'd love to canoe, but I feel too guilty. You know, it's like devil, the idle hands or the devil's workshop. I'm like, you know, paddle, you know. that wouldn't be bad. There was a young woman who felt too busy to ever have children. She's like, I just don't see how I can do it, you know. And I'm like, really? She goes, listen, it's we're rural. It's 70 miles to Target. Things take time here. Okay, I get that. And there was one woman who said leisure. Yeah, I think the last time I had leisure, I was like waiting. It was in my doctor's office waiting for a mammogram. I'm like, oh, with all those expired magazines. So it was really depressing. It's like, wow, even here in the heartland where you would think that people, you know, would have time. And then this woman like raced in the door and her hair was going every which way. And she was saying, oh my God, I was triple booked. I had this other thing to do and this thing happened and then I had to do this. And then I got stuck in traffic. Okay, so I live in Washington, D.C. If like there's one car that's stuck on I-66, it backs up all the way to 270 and you are missing that 6 o'clock pickup, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's like $20. Okay, another 20. So that's stressful. So I look out the window and I see one traffic light. I see three cars and cornfields. So what are you talking about? What traffic? And at that point, that's when the researcher, her name is Anne Burnett, she's wonderful. She looked at me kind of with this look because her contention is in modern life, and also the same guy who does the frenetic families, that in the late 20th and 21st century, we have made busyness the price of admission. It is now how we show our status. It is how we show we're important. It's basically how we fit in. And think about it. When you even talk to each other, how are you doing? Oh, fried. We're so busy. When was the last time you'd ever said nothing? Oh, what a loser. You know? What do you mean you don't have a bunch of stuff to do? What do you mean you don't have three Christmas parties you're trying to juggle? So it was really interesting. And so what Anne Burnett's contention is because as a society we have made busyness a sign of honor or badge of honor, that we will often create it when it doesn't exist, like a traffic jam in Fargo, North Dakota. And that was really, that was eye-opening to me. And her contention is that busyness is a choice. And at first I was just like, it is not. I am really busy. I used to call it virtuous busyness because I was just always like just doing stuff. But it was really interesting where she kind of does her research and where she came up with this idea or this theory is from holiday letters. And she's collected holiday and Christmas letters for decades. So we spent the afternoon going through her archive. And it's really interesting. Some of them had an A on the top of them. I'm like, A, like this is a good Christmas letter? What, you know, where does the A come from? And she said, A for authentic. And that's something I wanted to ask you about. You talk about being incongruent, you know, feeling congruent or incongruent. She said, the A's are for letters that are authentic, where they're not trying to show off their busyness. And there were not that many of them. I tell you, I would read some of these letters. And these are not people in New York and Boston and L.A. and Washington, D.C. These are people in, like, North Dakota and South Dakota and Ohio. And they're exhausting. You know, people going on Memorial Day weekend, taking a trip where they saw seven states, and these are big states out there. You know, and they were really exhausting. And back in the 60s, some of the very early letters, they were lovely, you know, blessings of the season, and we're so grateful to have you in our lives, sort of that simplicity that you're talking about. And they really have become these crazy brag sheets. But the interesting thing is when she was talking about it being a choice, and I was so resistant to that, she said, but in a sense, it's really a non-choice choice because we don't feel we can make the choice not to be busy because how else are we going to show that we fit in? How else are we going to show that we're important? So food for thought there. Let me, you know, over to you, Gretchen. What were some of the big lessons that you learned?
I want to talk about authenticity, but first, I have now designed a life where I have a lot of leisure time, but I have been embarrassed to actually say how much leisure time I have because of that badge of honor of busyness. You know, almost like, oh, geez, like I have a lot of leisure time. I must be spoiled or rich or this or that. And it's really the stigma that goes with leisure should be, we should start a new culture and just change the whole stigma. I have chosen a life where I get a lot done. I spend time with my family, but I have a lot of leisure time. And I'll be first to say I'm proud of it, finally. But part of talking about the authenticity and what was a big mindset for me to get rid of a lot of busyness is I quieted my mind. I literally just shut off consuming everybody else and comparing. Comparing is like the thief of joy, or what's the saying? And I just really had more, and when you say meditation, it sounds like, oh, I don't have time for meditation. But sometimes just being mindful and being in the moment and being present and just shutting everything off and actually letting yourself be bored. I let myself be bored, which was very uncomfortable, because I would even at the stoplight pick up my phone and scroll or read an email. Like, I was like having to consume something every minute. So I shut everything off. And with that, I found my inner voice. I found really who I was. I connected. Because my whole life, I was busy. In my 20s, I was chasing boys and partying and traveling the world and working on my career. And every decade, I was doing something different to keep me busy. And when I became true to myself, then I was able to live with full intention. And so every decision I make, is this authentic to me? Or am I doing this to please somebody? I'm a people pleaser. I want people to like me. And I think that's kind of human nature, right? But am I doing this where I'm trying to please somebody else, but I'm taking something from me? I'm taking something from my health, my family, my creativity time, certain priorities in my life. If I'm doing it just to please somebody else, or saying yes and going to this party when I really don't want to go, or volunteering to make cupcakes, I'm not going to do it. I'm not. That's it. I'm going to do things that are authentic to me. So that really got rid of a lot of stuff on my to-do list. You know, anything that was not going to honor my priorities, honor who I am, and that doesn't align with things that are important to me. So that was one of the ways I've been able to clear up my schedule. And there's a huge, for those of you that are parents, there's a lot of guilt. And so I had a lot of guilt, too, with taking care of myself and having leisure time and not saying yes. I don't want to be the parent that doesn't get involved, or I don't want to be, you know, there's so many things, there's so many pressure, and that's just society. So I had to get over the guilt, which was a process, and I actually am a work in process, too. Like, I'm still trying to get there, but much better than I used to be.
You know, you talk about the pressures, pressures that people feel, or comparing, or that you have to live up to certain things. And I think that was probably the biggest thing that I discovered, you know, as I was doing the reporting. And the subtitle of the book is Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. It really came from the Harvard psychologist Eric Erickson, who talked about the three great arenas of life. To have a good life is work, have, you know, time for meaningful work, and however you define that, the work of your life, you know, the Buddhists would say your dharma. But love, time for connection, and all of the happiness research in the world shows us one very simple truth, that we are happiest when we are connected to other people. It's people that make us happy, not necessarily going off to Bali, although now there's a volcano, you know, but it's really having that time for true connection and play. And that was always the part that I thought was, you know, that leisure was a waste of time, that I was too busy and too important to play, and that's for children. But what's fascinating about play and why leisure is so important is that we are really one of the only species that plays not only as juveniles. Other animal species play as juveniles. I'm not really sure why, but that we play as adults as well. And that actually that is one of the key things that makes us human. There is a Dutch philosopher who said we really shouldn't be called Homo sapiens, the thinking human, but Homo ludens, the playing human. Because when you think about it as an adult, it's not like you're necessarily going to have a tea party, although I suppose that's what Halloween is, right? You get to dress up. But it's imagination. It's sort of like playing with things. You know, Richard Feynman was a physicist who basically was watching kids wobble plates and kind of goof around. And, you know, he was sort of watching them play, and he was like, huh, that's interesting. I'm going to calculate those wobbles. And he was sort of playing, and that he ended up winning the Nobel Prize out of that sort of moment of levity and play. And so it kind of creates the, sort of these openings to imagine new worlds, new ways of being. And I guess what I would argue is that we really have a grand lack of imagination right now, and that some of these pressures at work This has really been since the 1980s. You see that in the United States, work hours have been ratcheting up, particularly for knowledge workers, and that really people think, oh, it was all technology. It really started before technology. And so now you've got this notion of the ideal worker as somebody who works all the time. You know, look at me, how awesome I am. I'm answering these emails at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, I've had people brag that they've spent the night at the office. I don't know if you guys have that, but you know, that whole idea of FaceTime and always being available. So we've come to really value that that's the best way to work. I don't know if you remember the Cadillac commercial a couple years ago. It's like, what makes us so great as Americans? We work all the time. You know, we only take 2 weeks of vacation, those stupid Europeans. Well, the interesting thing about that is that when you look at productivity data, the United States is pretty productive. I thought you had to work like a crazy person to get that kind of productivity. But if you look at productivity per hours worked, like how good are each one of those hours, I mean, do you know who's the most productive in the world? Norway. And they work 37.5 hours a week by law. You know who's about as productive per hour as we are? France. People hate that. France gets 6 weeks of vacation. They have paid parental leave. They have subsidized child care. And yeah, they're about as productive per hour as we are. So there's this huge myth out there that we have to work like maniacs to be really good. So that's one of the pressures that I think we don't really, it's like we're swimming in this water we don't even see. Another pressure is that we have to be these ideal mothers. That, you know, actually when you look at the research, what we expect mothers to be and do has never been higher. And we expect them to do it on their own, which is crazy. So we are in this crazy town about what we expect mothers and parents to do. It's almost punishing. Oh, and by the way, we have absolutely no social policy to support you. So you just have to figure it out on your own, or you have to hope that you have a nice boss and, you know, you'll kind of figure it out on your own. So we've kind of got this whole structure that doesn't really support the way that we work and live. And that's where so much of this overwhelm comes from, this real disconnect between the way we live and the way we think we should live, because these sort of external forces are really powerful. And the last thing I'll say about that is that the Pew Research Center just came out with a report earlier this week asking about gender roles, and they are still very entrenched. We still think men should be the breadwinner, that that's the best thing for a man to do. We still think women are empathetic and they should be the caregivers. Well, guess what? That's not the way that we live anymore. That was the 1950s. I mean, that's part of what keeps us sort of spinning in this overwhelm. It's like, why should we give you any kind of, you know, why should we change the way that we work? So that's a big part of what's pushing all of this. And I think for me, one of the most important things to do is take a moment to realize that and see how it plays in your own mind. And then once you've seen that, make those decisions like, well, okay, how am I going to navigate this? And how am I going to choose whether to, you know, buy into that or to try to work and live differently? What about you?
I was sitting here just impressed with how much data you have, and I'm just in awe because, I wrote my books based off of some research and a lot of experimentation and kind of quieting things down, but I'm absolutely intrigued by the data that you've found.
Well, you know, you were
stumped.
Oh, wow. That's not the
moment.
No.
Stumped moment. Yeah.
So, but this is interesting. You were talking about guilt, and that would be a really interesting thing to explore a little bit more. Why do you think that there is that sense of guilt, and then what can people do about it?
I think guilt is probably the single most destructive, especially for moms, destructive, useless emotion that we can have. And I have been, when I was sick, laying on the couch, barely able to take care of myself, I was consumed with guilt because I felt like I'm not a good wife. My husband should leave me. I'm not a good mom. My daughter deserves a better parent than me. You know, I was so worried about everyone else. And I did kind of think I was dying. I thought, well, maybe I'm dying, because it took the doctors a long time to figure out what was going on. But guilt was like the biggest emotion that I can remember just having. I was permeated with it. And I think it's self-imposed. And I do think it's the culture. the culture of you have to be a Pinterest mom. You have to be, right? Pinterest is like, I love it, hate it, right? you have to do this, you have to look this way, you have to act this way, you have to get this done, this accomplished. And with women in this day and age, we're doing it all. You know, I am independent, so part of me is like, I can do it all. But you want to know what? Nobody can do it all. And my sister-in-law told me this a long time ago. She's like, don't do too much. Because if you take something onto your plate, you're going to have to take something off. But what a lot of us women do is we just keep taking and taking and taking. Okay, yeah, I'll add this to my plate. And then before you know it, we're just falling down. So I wrote a book this year. And you know what I did? I stopped cooking. It's just something I had to do. I couldn't do it all. I boiled pasta, maybe did a crock pot meal once in a while, steamed some vegetables, and that was pretty much it. And you want to know, my husband and kids are fine. And I'm fine. There's just only so much we can do. And I had to stop being guilty about that. My kids are well fed, and my husband's okay, and I'm okay. And we all lived. And that's what, at the end of the day, when you look at guilt and you look at, really break it down, like, why do I feel guilty? What can I come up with as an alternative? There's always the answer, and it's usually a very simple answer, and it's usually taking something away.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I call it the lesson of the Twinkie. When I was sort of feeling like, you think about it, who do we think is judging us? You know, certainly there are people that are judging you if you're not like perfect and doing it all, so to speak. But why would we even want them in our house? Why would we like them? You know, why do we think that the bad housewife police is going to come and like with their, you know, Thanksgiving check off? It's like, do you centerpiece? Yes. And yet there is this pressure that women feel to be, to sort of like be perfect in a way, if you will. So my lesson really came, we were running off to my son's band concert. And so like the good ideal mother, I had promised to bring something to the bake sale. But like the good ideal worker, I was working too much and I totally forgot. And so we were rushing off to the concert because, of course, we were late. And I remembered. I'm like, oh, my God, we have to stop. We have to go stop at this store. And they have these cupcakes, and we'll put them in this little basket. And, you know, then it'll look sort of homemade. And we'll take them to the bake sale, and nobody will ever know. And my husband sort of looked at me, and he just goes, yeah. And he goes in, and he comes back out with a box of Twinkies. I'm like, oh my God, I can't bring this to the table with all those other mothers who spent all this time baking stuff. I refuse. You know, I can't bring them Twinkies. And my husband looked at me and he said, you know what? This isn't about you. This is about the bake sale and making money for the band. And these are going to go. And they did. And you're absolutely right. It didn't mean that I was a terrible mother. It didn't mean that I, wasn't a great Pinterest mom. I'm a little too old for Pinterest, maybe. But, I think that that's the other thing that's really important to understand is like that sometimes these judgments that we feel, you have to kind of stop and almost disrupt that cycle that it becomes so automatic that we feel like we have to do these things. The other thing, you were talking about guilt. Guilt is a really real thing for women. Now, this is bizarre. I actually found leisure researchers. We don't have very many in the United States. And it's so interesting to talk about feeling embarrassed about leisure. I talked to this one leisure researcher in North Carolina, and she said, yeah, my mom is even embarrassed to tell people what I do. So if you're an academic and you study leisure and it's embarrassing in the United States, that tells you an awful lot about why we have a hard time taking time for ourselves. Most of the great leisure research is done in Europe, not surprisingly, where they really do take time off, and in Canada. And what's really fascinating, there is a group of feminist leisure researchers. I mean, who knew? So I called them up, and it was really fascinating. They did this study, and they talked to women all around the world. And it didn't really matter your age or your race or your ethnicity, your religion, your, kind of what country you came from. Almost to a one, women said they did not deserve leisure time. They didn't feel like they, you know, deserved to have time for themselves. They had to earn it. And the only way then to earn that leisure or free time was to get to a very long, get to the end of a very long to-do list. And guess what? The to-do list never ends. And so all around the world, you know, so I wanted to figure out, well, how did we get there? How is it that we don't feel like we have to earn this kind of time? But when you think about it, women have never had a history or culture of leisure ever in the history of the world. You know, if you look at the classic that was written about leisure, The Theory of the Leisure Class by Thorsten Veblen, he dismisses women on page 2. He talks about how leisure was always sort of the provenance of high-status men, and the further away you got from drudge work, the more you showed your status. Because a century ago, instead of showing your status in busyness, you showed it in leisure, you know, the idle rich. And so he said, and all the drudge work of society is done by the servants, the slaves, comma, and also all the women, period. So if it's hard for you to make time for yourself, if it's hard to, like, you know, like Nike, sorry for Reebok, you know, Nike says just do it. You know what? It's really hard for women to give themselves permission to just do it. And I think what's so exciting and so confusing right now is that we are in a period of unbelievable tumult and change. Women have never been at this place before in history. You know, we've had, you know, workplaces opened up. We're at this point where we can really think about what does it mean to be human, you know, and not just sort of defined by your gender. And men as well. It's a really exciting time. What does it mean to be fully human? You know, and men have they're just as physiologically and biologically wired for nurture as women are. And the wild thing is the science shows that, and we found that out by accident because we didn't think it was true. But men's brains in the studies, they light up in the same pathways of nurture and communication. Men's bodies, their testosterone level drops when they become fathers. They also produce prolactin, which is the same hormone that produces breast milk, although not in the same quantity. You know, and we didn't know all of that. So men, I mean, think about it. We are the same species. It's not that surprising that men and women nurture and men and women can have time for meaningful work, whatever that is that you define it, and that men and women do deserve time for leisure and play.
We have just a few more minutes. So I was going to talk about just a couple takeaways. It's very interesting because we approach something very differently, but in reading everything that you have done, we have a similar ways to decrease busyness and get more leisure and bring more joy into life. But so I'd love to hear a couple of your takeaways. And for me, I would say one of the biggest things that has changed my life personally was shutting things off and quieting my mind. Just being mindful, quiet, getting bored, calming, even if it's 5 minutes a day. Just a simple, just quiet time. Sometimes the best ideas come from that, and the biggest revelations. Think about when you're in the shower. That's when I have, like, or driving alone on the road, right? Quiet time. Every single day, do that for yourself, and then so much comes from that. You start to get to know yourself again when you kind of shut your mind. And another thing, I wrote about this in Simplicity, and it sounds kind of odd, but I was trying to think of something different to say than because we have a lot of the similar suggestions, but be fluid, like a river. I find that many of us, if we're type A, we're rigid with our ideals and we have expectations and things have to be a certain way, and then we stress out and we overcomplicate things, and it's just, then we break and we freak out. And when I decided I was going to be fluid like a river, you're still strong. Rivers are strong. But you kind of go with the flow and you relax and you take things as they come. And you're malleable. And I have some notes that I guess I'm forgetting my notes. But basically, just kind of relax and ease into it and not put so much pressure, because with that pressure, you break.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, for me, probably one of the biggest lessons that I learned. I wrote about time. I think a lot about time and do some research. I still read time diary research. It's fascinating. And probably the biggest lesson to me, because I was always feeling guilty that I was not cramming enough into the day, you know, and I was working with a productivity coach. And, maybe if I could just figure out how to, be more helpful, put the stuff on my calendar in a better way or something like that. And the biggest lesson I learned, she asked me, I was like, all right, well, tell me what you're going to do in the next week. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this and this and this and this, and I got to do this and this and this. And it was basically, I like kind of set this agenda for myself that would have taken me, I don't know, years to do. I'm like, and I'm going to do it by next week. And so the very first time we had, the next week we had our coaching session, and she said, so, how long did it take you before you realized you couldn't do everything you thought you'd do? And I kind of hated her in that moment. Because she was really right. And I'm like, well, I kind of knew even as I was saying it that there was no way I could do it. And what that really taught me is that, you can't manage time. Time is sort of, it always is what it is. But what you can manage are your own priorities and your expectations of what you can do in time. And so that's where probably the most important thing, like Gretchen was saying, just take that moment to pause, kind of take that breath, disrupt those automatic cycles of busyness, automatic, like I have to live up to all of these different ideals. I've got to be an ideal worker, an ideal mother. And that affects you whether you've got kids or not, because that's sort of what society expects you to be. I've got to, kind of take that moment to pause, disrupt that cycle, and then really do figure out, well, what is most important? And then set your expectations accordingly. Because I realized, if you set your expectations so high, you know what? You're always going to be failing. You're always going to be behind. You're always going to feel inadequate. So, so that was a huge lesson. And so in the mornings when I have a running partner and we'll finish our run, and we turn to each other and we'll say, what's your one thing today? Not your 75, not your 100. What's your one thing? And that was really hard at first. Well, I got to do this and this and this and this. But if you really focus, there's usually one thing that's most important, and it can be something from work. Or it could be like, my daughter's just been feeling down. I just really want to do something special with her today. Or like, I'm tired, and I just kind of want to do something just goofy and fun. But it's one thing. And you know what? If you do, you usually can find time to do that one thing. And then at the end of the day, it feels like a win instead of like always being busy and crazy and behind. So that's one of the biggest things that I do, your one thing. But really taking that time to pause is really important.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a great time to transition to Q&As, because we have these wonderful speakers here. So I think now we want to actually open up for everybody, because I'm sure everybody's kind of itching to have some questions. But let's do a round of applause before we do that. And before we open it up, maybe I'll throw one quick question your way. And it's maybe the question is around the one obstacle that you mentioned was about the we love busyness because it gives us status, basically, right? What are some of the other things that might be in a way for us to actually not get pulled? And maybe for you personally, get pulled into the busy life? Because if it were easy, we would be already all doing it. And yet we have a full house of women who are obviously looking for some advice here. So what would you suggest?
Yeah, what do you think, Gretchen? What gets in the way, and what can people do to kind of overcome some of that?
What gets in the way? It's usually other people's expectations or other people's agendas. Following your own agenda versus other people's agendas. And I know that's difficult in the workplace, but that there's a lot of stuff that you can weed out. And again, when you're following other people versus your own, I find that you're busy, you're consuming time with other people's stuff versus what's truly important to you.
Yeah.
If you can keep the doors still closed for the Q&As for the people who are staying, that would be great.
One of the things that that I think is really powerful, and we've sort of talked about that, is mindset. What you think and what you think you should be doing or what you think is important. When I was at the Washington Post, I ran this experiment. We called it the Time Hacker Challenge. And people would write in with something they really wanted to make time for. talk about why it was so important and what was getting in the way. And then I would match them up with like a coach or an expert, and then they would work together for 21 days. And then at the end of the 21 days, I got to interview both of them to see what did they do, and how were they doing? Were they able to make time for this important thing? And it was fascinating. I did enough of them that there was really a theme that emerged. I mean, it was fantastic because I got all these great tips every week when I interviewed these people. Oh, I got to try that, which was great. But, you know, what was the most important thing out of each one of these, because the tips were always a little different, and they were great, but it was almost like the people had to give themselves permission that what they thought was important really was valuable, and that they had to give themselves permission to take that time. And once they did, you know, then everything sort of fell into place. And I think that was the biggest lesson to me, is that sometimes the biggest obstacles are in our own minds. And, you know, it really takes that shift to be able to change the way we live and think.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, let's open it up. What questions you might have? Let's start over there, and number two here, and let's take it from there.
We thought the mics were full.
We
thought the mics
two,
were
three.
For...
Okay.
We lined
so
up at the mics.
That lady over there who's standing on the left. Oh, you have to come up. So could you please come up?
They told us to line up at the mics.
They
told us to line up the mics to ask questions.
Oh, really? Okay. So why don't we follow the line of the mics process?
Okay.
Do I have to press? Can you hear?
Me? You?
So I, Bridget, you, this question is for both of you. Gretchen had said earlier that, you know, am I doing this to be authentic to me, or am I doing it to please someone else? And I find at work I'm able to get my job done, and I've been able to whittle it down to do that in the 8 hours. But I have two kids and a husband, and I find that most of what my business is doing things to please them, because I want to make them happy. But it doesn't always make me happy. It's, you know, when I bake the cupcakes, it's not for the bake sale. It's because my daughter loves me to bring the cupcakes to school and be part of the bake sale. So most of that stuff that I'm doing is to please them and not me, but it needs to be done because it makes me a better parent, makes them love me, makes me love them. You know, all that's intertwined. So how do I cut that out and still to be less busy, but still show them how much I love them? And how else can I show them that they're a priority in my life?
Well, I would just say some of that is, you know, whether you bake cupcakes once a quarter or every single day or whatever, you know, it's like creating space and time for yourself is what makes you a better parent. You know, if you're only doing things to please other people, and then there's a little bit of resentment in there, or you're feeling a little drained or burned out, you know, that's going to taint the relationships that you have as well. So really creating that space for yourself does make you better at work and in the relationships that you have. You know, and like with my kids, it was like with field trips, I remember feeling so guilty. It's like, oh, I should go on every single field trip. But it was really difficult. And so what we did is we created expectations. It's like, I will do one field trip a month, pick which one. And so then it wasn't sort of like, I didn't feel so guilty, I didn't feel like a bad mother. And then the one was just a really great experience. So we did fewer, better things.
I would say the same thing. I set limits. Because baking cupcakes doesn't make you a great parent. That doesn't define you. You being present and loving them and caring for them, that's what makes you a great parent, not because you bake every single time. And I know that my daughter, she likes for me to be involved, especially because that display shows her. But you can set limits, you know, so that you're not doing it all. And the more you respect yourself and set limits, and she sees that you honor yourself, she's going to learn to honor herself. So you set the example of, it doesn't mean I love you any less. I'm not going to bake cupcakes this time, but how about you and I go out for ice cream? Or, you know, something like a little fun, a little special bonding time where it's leisure time, but it's not you doing something that you're going to have a little bit of resentment towards, because they sense that and they know that. So I think limits.
So should we just go back and forth?
Yeah.
So actually I have more of a comment than a question. I am older than most people in this room, and my career was in the 80s and 90s, and I promise you, in 1980, it was just as crazy as it is now, even though it was analog and typewriters. That we earned less money, of course. And I think what I have seen is materialism grow. We buy more, we're lazier. But worst of all, and I work or have worked most of my career in media and film, most of all, the advertising industry is to blame for this crap that we go through. Mm. We are bombarded with images of spotless stainless steel kitchens and spotless children and healthy, slim, handsome husbands and beautiful women. It's true. It's not real. And it never was. And the more we are bombarded with the Martha Stewart lifestyle and how to do everything perfectly, we're going to suffer for it. So my little bit of advice is stop watching this stuff and just take it with a pinch of salt. And
yes.
That is brilliant. And the one thing I will say about that is, you know, again, from Time Diary Research, when they started looking in the 60s and they wanted to see, it's like, well, you know, now there are all these wonderful, you know, time-saving devices, you know, washing machines and this and that. They wanted to see, has it saved the American housewife all this time? And what they've discovered is that they were spending the same amount of time on housework as women in Bulgaria who didn't have any of these wonderful time-saving devices. And the reason was exactly that. With advertising, then, the standards became even higher. Ring around the collar. Oh, no. So, I mean, think about that, too. That is very much a part of those pressures that are out there. And you've got to shut them out, because otherwise you're going to be living everybody else's life but your own.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, because I did write about that in my book, Simplicity, about curating what we have in our life and shutting out the multi-billion dollar advertising agency. And that is something that we didn't address up here. So thank you for bringing that up, of the pressure of having, and that was one of my things. I had to achieve more. I had to drive this. I had to buy this. And I was caught up in consumerism. And it's good to detox from that.
Yeah, and sometimes we feel guilty that we don't spend enough time with our children, so then you want to buy them more stuff, you know, which is crazy because they don't need it. They'll play with the box. And the other thing that I don't think we realize is that, again, Time Diary research shows that women today spend more time with their children, more interactive, high-quality time than stay-at-home mothers did in the 60s. And when you think, what? That is insane. I didn't believe it at first. And then you look at the charts, women have given up time for sleep, time for personal care, time for adult relationships, time with their spouse, and they spend virtually every minute of their leisure time with their children, which is not good for the kids who need time to be by themselves and get bored, and it is not good for you. So yes, absolve the guilt.
My question is about friendships. I met a group of girls when I became a mom, you know, and everything was so hyper crazy at the time and, you know, wanting to do the best things and be a good mom and all that. So my question is, so now that I've, you know, had this moment, you know, last year where I'm like, this is just craziness. All this is just crazy to me. So I'm not really busy anymore, which is nice. And actually, I'm lucky to have a wonderful husband who does everything that you're talking about. So I actually probably should do more. I'll enjoy it. But my question is, so I still have these girlfriends who, you know, gosh, I don't want to see any more Elf on the Shelf pictures, like of them doing these creative scenes and, you know, taking pictures of the cute lunches that they did and the handwritten napkins. And it is just insane to me. And like maybe like a year ago, I would have done some of this stuff too. But now I'm just like, oh my God, this is crazy town, you know? So how do you like, you know, they're still nice people. And I do vent to my husband and tell him like, oh my God, they're talking about like their kid taking the bus next year in kindergarten and how it's freaking them out. So clearly it's like crazy. So my question is like, how do you remain, like keep those friendships and work with when you've already had that moment that you're not going to live that life? You know, do you just separate those friendships or do you keep them? And how does that, I don't even know what to do. Like, you know, they're nice people, but gosh, I can't take those pictures anymore.
Hide.
Yeah.
You've got. So what I do is I'm very different than a lot of moms my age, especially because I'm an older mom, and I feel like the older moms have more to prove or something. So there's a lot of competition. But I just don't partake, and I have a lot of friends, and I just say, oh, I'm different. I don't do that. Oh, Elf on the Shelf, I forgot to do that. I just did that this morning quickly before they got up. And I'm just who I am, and I don't partake, and I try to talk about other things. You know, like when you get together with your girlfriends, you know, bring the conversation around to things that you have in common. Mm. And I just share, like, oh, yeah, I don't do that anymore. You know, I'm just who I am. Mm. You know?
Yeah, you know, so I never did Elf on the Shelf. I don't even know kind of what that is. But, you know, I think what's important is that how does it make you feel? You know, it's like everybody makes different choices. Everybody's at different points in terms of what they're aware of and what's important to them. And if that's still where they are, if it's not, you know, if it's not making you feel badly, if it's not making you worried, you know, then, you know, find a new way of connecting with them. But I think what is important when it's tough, and it is, it's tough to push against the status quo of busyness and always on and overdoing and overparenting and overworking. That's really what the pressure is. And it's hard to push against that on your own. So it's really important to find peers and a network of support. So maybe, you know, sure, they're nice people and stay friendly with them, but find people who share your values and share that sense of, you know, that moment where you just sit on the floor and blow bubbles with your daughter or your son and you're not taking a picture and posting it on social media. It is just that moment, and that's enough. Find people who value that as well.
So thank you, everybody. I want to be very respectful for everybody's time. I know we have probably numerous more questions, but round of applause for Gretchen and Bridget. Please remember that they are also going to be signing their books, actually, in the exhibit hall right after this session. So please come. And thank you, everybody, for your time and partaking in the session.